It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
We are Bloomberg Business Week live at the Milken Global Institute Conference on the West Coast in Beverly Hills. Steve Case is with us. He's a name well known to the Bloomberg audience, founder of AOL, of course, a company he ran for many years. Today he is CEO at Revolution, his venture capital arm. Nice to see you. How are
great
you?
Great to be with you. No, it's great to be back at the Milken Conference and
it
great to be
good,
back at a
it?
Live conference with actually real people actually talking to each other.
When you come to an event like this, what is it that you look to get out of it?
Well, Mike Milken has been a friend for a long time, actually an investor in the Revolution Fund. So, he asked us to come out. Of course, we say yes. And the sessions are interesting. I just did want to do another one on Wednesday. But like many conferences, a lot of it is just the networking opportunity to see people you haven't seen in a while and meet some new people. So the intellectual content is always compelling, but I think the real value, which is why people like these kind of conferences,
right,
and why it's hard to replicate, maybe impossible to replicate on Zoom. Because you don't really, you get the actual content of the panels, but you don't get the broader context and the interactions, the networking, bumping into people, learning new things that you get from being in person.
So does that tell you that the actual in-person conference is back or is going to return? It's not. There was concern, a year ago that, hey, with us all doing these virtual conferences,
yeah,
virtual panels, we weren't going to go back to stuff like this.
Well, I think it'll be a mix. I think people, there's still a lot of great panels that you can get through online, and that will continue. But also, people will see the value in attending in person. And so I think the notion that everything was going to go virtual, I think, is a little crazy. The notion that everything's going to return to normal and people are going to be back in their offices 5 days a week and they're going to go to conferences like they always did, that's not going to happen either. Clearly, it's going to be something in the middle. It's going to be a grand experiment for society, and nobody knows exactly how it's going to play out as people can sort of separate their work and their life and decide maybe to live somewhere differently than where they've historically have been working, which ties in with some of the themes we've been talking about with Rise to Rest and regional entrepreneurship. And in terms of conferences, there definitely will be some hybrid events like this one where,
right,
there's value to be in person, but there's also people are included who want to join remotely.
Steve, how has the pandemic and maybe the rise of certain technologies or the virtual space or telehealth? I just did a panel on technology and longevity. How has it changed maybe your thinking about where I want to be committing money going
forward?
Well,
Revolution, we have a growth fund, a venture fund, mm-hmm, and a seed fund. And some of the things that got accelerated in the pandemic, thankfully, we were investors, including telehealth, a company,
right,
called Talkspace. And made a number of other investments in companies like BigCommerce, which is an e-commerce platform. You saw an acceleration,
right,
obviously, of e-commerce. So we've seen some of the pandemic dynamics accelerate, some of the tech trends accelerate the growth of some of the companies in that sector, and some of that will continue. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that acceleration essentially is resulting in adoption of things in a year that might have otherwise taken 5 or 10 years, and concepts that seem sort of foreign, including telehealth, by the mm-hmm. way that been around for 25 years, but always was viewed as kind of fringy. When it's your only option, suddenly it becomes pretty central.
Right.
People find out, hey, it works pretty well, and then start saying, once they are able to go back to the doctor's office, they'll say, which things can I continue to do remotely, and which things I really do need to do by going to an office.
What's the government role in that, though? The CARES Act expanded, right, made it so that the insurance companies were covering those telehealth visits. They may not continue that. I mean, this is where you got to think, come on, this is a way of doing things maybe better.
Yeah, no, I think the genie's out of the bottle on telehealth. I think it's if people do realize, and including the physicians as well as the patients, that they're valued. Again, it doesn't work for every interaction with the healthcare
right.
system, but it works for a lot of those interactions, and it is more convenient and more cost-effective. I think the basic trends in healthcare will continue to be, how do you reimagine a system that's too complicated, too expensive? Often the outcomes aren't even particularly good.
Right.
To have a more nimble, agile, entrepreneurial healthcare system where, from a consumer, patient, individual standpoint, there is more convenience, there is more affordability, and there are better outcomes. And I think there'll be continued innovation across the board. One of the companies we backed in Chicago, a company called Tempus, is growing like crazy, just at around an $8 billion valuation, 2,000 employees. That started by a founder whose wife was diagnosed with breast cancer and got so many different opinions. He said, this is crazy. This is a data problem. I'm going to go fix it. And he's doing a great job. So we're seeing that now really all across the country.
Hey, Steve, one thing that we saw play out during the pandemic is the idea of people working remotely, people leaving big cities and going to smaller areas where the quality of life may be better, they may be able to buy more. I'm wondering, that revolution, when you think about areas of the country where you want to deploy capital, you've always been focused on this idea of areas outside of Silicon Valley,
right.
outside of New York City, away from the coasts. Has that shifted? Has that increased in the last 18 months as people have moved? Have you seen a real resurgence in these areas?
Yeah, I think there's been a tipping point where people, the brain drain that we've seen in the last half century, people leaving parts of the country to go to the coast, go to Silicon Valley, because that's where kind of where the money is and all the other people in the innovation economy were. Now they sheltered in place someplace else, said, hey, come to think of it, I kind of like this place. And some of them are moving. Most will continue to work for their existing company remotely, but some will decide to be part of that startup ecosystem, start something, or join a startup in that. So I think the pandemic, one of the silver linings of a terrible tragedy, will be an acceleration of the rise of rest, acceleration of regional entrepreneurship, and we'll start seeing more dispersion of talent, more dispersion of capital, and some of the big successes of tomorrow will be in different parts of the country that might surprise people.
25 seconds, really quick. Hybrid. I feel like there's such a debate about that. Is it here to stay? And the companies that don't do it, are they going to miss out on?
It's here to stay, but again, different companies, different scale, different industries will have different situations. But in general, I think people will adopt hybrid and think you'll be in the office some of the time, mostly for collaborative work. You'll be remote most of the time when you're doing work that you can do individually. And the companies that insist that everybody come to the office every day are the companies that try to operate exclusively on an all remote basis. I think there's some challenges for both of them. So I think most organizations will adopt some form of hybrid.
Never enough time. Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
You're a gem. Steve Case, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer at Revolution, right here on Bloomberg Business Week. So Milken is all about bringing together individuals from many walks of our life. Big component, of course, is the financial one. Here at Milken, and a familiar name to our Bloomberg audience, David Hunt, President and CEO of the asset management firm PGIM, and on-site here at Milken. First of all, nice to have you here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you both. Thank you for having me.
You did a panel with our colleague Scarlett Fu. And you told us before we got on air about a little survey she did. Tell us about that.
No, she asked the entire audience how many people thought inflation was transitory, and not a single person raised their hand.
And it was a big audience.
It was a big audience, full ballroom. And then she turned to the panelists and she asked us, and at least three of the very large asset managers all raised their hand, including myself, to say that we thought it was. And I think that was a really interesting divergence of opinion, which led to, I thought, a very fruitful discussion on what exactly it means to be transitory.
So we're all seeing the same data. We're all seeing the same surveys. We're all seeing the same numbers. Why do you think it's transitory?
Because I think that we don't give enough weight to some of the long-term deflationary forces that are happening. So there's three buckets of things that are happening within the inflation numbers. There's some things which are actually going to be higher for a while. Housing is a good example. We've not built enough houses in this country for a decade. That's not going to get solved in the next 2 years. That will stay high for a while. Commodities is another one I would give you. Then there's all kinds of things around chips and the price of lumber and your used car and things that I think most people do believe is actually going to come up and then will come back down. But while all of that is happening, these long-term forces of digital transformation and demographics, which have been what has kept inflation low for the last decade, are continuing, and in fact, I would say have accelerated over the course of the pandemic. So I do think that we'll be sitting here in 2024, and again, important to when you define, you know, transitory, and inflation, because of these long-term drivers, will be back down below 2%.
Well, and talk to us about digital transformation demographics. What do you mean specifically?
So the common way of referring to this is the Amazon effect. But
okay.
It is effectively the belief that as more and more shopping is done in a digital way, people compare prices, prices come down, supply chain moves to ever more divergent and lower cost areas.
Right.
And we actually see prices decline. And it's certainly happened over the last decade, for sure. And, of course, digital transformation has had probably 5 years of experience in the last 18 months, right?
Right, right.
So
it's
we're
been
seeing
sped
more
up.
Of it.
What about the demographic component? Are you talking about aging?
Well, no.
Or?
Well, it's actually it's more about how many people do we have retired versus how many people we have working.
Okay.
And we'll come back to this a little bit in our labor market discussion. But, you know, there's a lot of people who've decided, you know what, I've had enough. I'm actually going to retire from my job. So that ratio has actually gotten worse through the pandemic.
Well, let's talk labor market, because I hear what you're saying. And I think to myself, what about the imbalance that we have when it comes to labor market right now? Too many workers who do not want to work right now, and employers who don't necessarily want to raise wages enough to pull people off the sidelines. Eventually, one of those things has to shift. Do you get concerned that wages will rise so much that inflation will not be transitory as a result of these demographic or digital transformative factors?
So my guess is that the wage piece of this is going to be a very important part of it, but also that we will see many companies decide that they are actually going to invest in technology. That means they don't need to bring a lot of
restaurant industry
back.
Is already doing
like,
it.
We see great examples of that now.
Yeah.
When you even because you come through airports, all of a sudden you don't need somebody to check you out anymore.
Right.
So we are going to see some of these job classifications are just not going to be demanded anymore, and they're going to be replaced with technology. On the other hand, there will be a class of workers who have skills that are necessary. They are going to see wages go up, and I actually think that will be very positive for the economy.
30 seconds left, David. Forgive us. But are we at risk of seeing the Fed make a mistake in terms of policy because of like the hand? Like
so they're in a tough spot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think most of us would say from a market's point of view, we're ready for the end of emergency measures. We're actually out of that. And so we can start ending quantitative easing. You know, into next year, rates can begin to rise a little bit.
Next year. Yeah.
But the problem with that is that they have this dual mandate. And actually, as they look at it, the labor markets have a very long way to go. So we are encouraging them to think in new ways about how to measure the participation rate and whether we should ever think we are going back to that old normal.
And I feel like Milken is – that's the kind of conversations you have here. Like we've got to rethink and kind of get away from maybe the old ways of thinking about things. David Hunt,
right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
David Hunt, he's president and CEO at PGIM, joining us here at Milken.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
In the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it's part of the special double persuasion issue. Tim, there's a story about the families and groups and friends and what they are all doing to kind of win back loved ones with extreme views.
Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. David Yaffe Bellany is legal reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. The group that Carol referred to, Joel, it's called Parents for Peace. It counsels a gentle approach to those who've been seduced by ideologies such as QAnon, Islamicism, and white nationalism. And Joel, demand for its services, well, they've never been higher.
That's right. And, you know, when we thought about putting this persuasion issue together, there are a couple of themes that we were really interested in exploring. And I think David's story here, which he co-wrote with Sophia Kai, I thought actually was maybe the most important of that, just from events of the past year, especially like looking at January 6th. It just calls into question, like, you know, when people go for extreme views and fall into an extremism, like, what do you do? And how do you get those people back? And not only does that have implications for society, but it also has implications for, you know, in a much more immediate sense, families, right? And here we are, like, holidays just around the corner, and it's like all those interactions from, like, you know, from the QAnons on down. But, you know, I thought David's story, because it focused on Parents for Peace, it actually made this be something that has some tangible, actionable presence. And so, David, I just kick it over to you. What did you learn from doing the reporting on this story? Since it goes places, a lot of people, you know, especially if they're directly impacted by this, aren't always comfortable talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who are interested in extremism and understanding its roots and thinking about what to do about it have focused on, you know, the proliferation of misinformation online and the kind of the sort of circumstances that lead people down that kind of extreme path, and, you know, what we can do about that, whether it's, you know, changing how tech companies operate or other such things. But I think there's been, you know, less focus on the kind of more pragmatic question and the more kind of family-centered question of, you've got a brother or a sister or a father or somebody who subscribes to one of these extreme ideologies. What do you do to win them back in a kind of very intimate and personal way? And so that's what I was hoping to figure out, you know, as I reported this story. And you know, I learned a lot of different things. But I mean, one thing that became clear to me early on is that in a lot of these cases, it's not about persuasion so much as it is about figuring out what the underlying problem is in somebody's life that made them susceptible to this extreme idea. So maybe they're really lonely and they found some sort of strange warped community in this extreme world. You know, how do you give them community in other places so that you don't have to, you know, convince them that QAnon is wrong, but, you know, you put them in a place where they no longer turn to those ideologies for comfort.
So, David, tell us the story of Amy and her son, Jack, and the opening of your story, because it has an absolutely riveting opening that really goes into detail about what this family experienced. And how also did you get Amy to speak to you guys?
So in November 2018, Jack was a 16-year-old living in the southern U.S. with his parents. You know, Jack's a pseudonym. His mother, Amy, is also a pseudonym. You know, he had grown kind of increasingly obsessed with radical Islam. And this is a, you know, white Christian family. But, you know, Jack had started watching beheading videos online. He was obsessed with ISIS. He was on all sorts of chat rooms in which Islamic radicals were discussing possible attacks on American landmarks. And eventually it got to the point that Jack was so deep in this world that the FBI showed up at his house on this day in November 2018. They raided the house. Jack was eventually charged in juvenile court with making terrorist threats against the U.S. He was, you know, fortunate to get a year of probation rather than any prison time, mostly because it was really all talk. You know, he wasn't at the FBI didn't find any evidence that he was seriously capable of launching some kind of attack. But this was a incredibly traumatic moment for his family, as you can imagine. And Amy, his mother, spent, you know, years after this trying to figure out a way to, you know, draw him away from this extreme worldview. And, you know, even after the FBI had come and gone, he was still, you know, reading the same things, kind of spouting the same extremist rhetoric. And so she was concerned that, you know, something worse could happen down the line. And eventually she found this group, Parents for Peace, and turned to them for help in kind of combating Jack's extreme worldview. And, you know, Parents for Peace introduced me to the family. I, you know, spoke with Amy on the phone several times. I ended up spending some time with her, Jack, and the rest of the family where they live. I visited their home. And so, you know, I think I was able to, you know, establish a relationship with them that way through many conversations and get to the point where they were comfortable discussing these sorts of sensitive topics.
So, David, what's the backstory for Parents for Peace? Because obviously that's the organization that's making all this possible. How did it come into being, and who are the key players there?
Sure. So it started with a, a tragedy in 2009 where a young man named Carlos Bledsoe shot a couple of people at a military recruiting base in Little Rock, Arkansas. Carlos had grown up as kind of a normal kid in Tennessee, and then had become an Islamic radical, and committed this shooting sort of in the name of his views. He was sentenced to life in prison. His father, Melvin Bledsoe, sort of wondered, what can I do to turn this horrible experience into something productive? How can I get meaning and purpose out of it? And eventually, he started Parents for Peace about 6 years after the shooting. Designed as a group to help families that are grappling with loved ones who have extreme views. He eventually sort of hands control of the organization to a woman named Miriam Churchill, who's a veteran social worker, a French-Moroccan, got her start counseling prostitutes in Marseille in the 80s during the AIDS epidemic. And she, conducted, about a year of research where she traveled the country talking to former extremists, the families of extremists, trying to understand what the root of the issue was and to develop some kind of treatment approach that could allow her to help families that were in the position of the Bledsoes before some tragedy happened.
Well, it's remarkable, and it's like doing an intervention on a different level, but it's a fascinating story and amazing the access that you got, and unfortunately we have to leave it there, but we highly recommend folks go to BloombergBusinessWeek.com, check it out, that story, and you can read it in its entirety. It's also in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, which is, as we mentioned, a special double issue with the persuasion issue, and there's lots of great stuff, including David's story. Joel, David, thank you. Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber in the Interactive Broker Studio. Bloomberg News legal reporter David Yaffe Bellany. He's joining us, or was joining us, on the phone in D.C. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stanovic, live at Milken in Beverly Hills. We're coming back in just a moment.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stanovic on Bloomberg Radio.
It's Bloomberg Business Week. Tim Stanovic and Carol Masser live from Beverly Hills. Well, earlier today, we sat down with Siemens USA President and CEO Barbara Humpton here at the Milken Global Conference. In this excerpt, Humpton talks about the recent White House meeting on supply chain constraints for chips. Check it out.
Kudos to the White House and Department of Commerce for bringing together players all along the supply chain. Those who are, end users putting chips into end products all the way back to fabs, et cetera. And really what the White House and Commerce are looking for is how can they remove roadblocks? How can they help set up systems so that we improve the supply chain all along? One of the big things is transparency. It's very much like cyber.
What does that mean for chips?
I'll tell you, in cybersecurity, what we've committed as an industry is to tell each other when we encounter issues, and it keeps everybody else alert and aware. We know that a threat to one is a threat to all. Same things with chips. Where are we encountering bottlenecks? What types of chips are we having issues with? And by sharing that information, then where the federal government can help is if there's anything they can do, regulatory or otherwise, to unblock those blockades, then they'll get involved.
Has that happened yet? Have you been able to see anything change since that meeting just a couple of weeks ago?
Well, the number one thing is we've just started the reporting. So, yes. And I do know that this is a very open administration. They're taking phone calls incessantly from folks who are dealing with issues.
It's easy to get to the White House right now on this.
Absolutely. A top issue for them.
When you talk about chips and just the problems, what is the problem? Is it just that there's just not enough being manufactured? What is the real nut that we're trying to crack here?
Here's where we are. We had a global supply chain that was tuned to just in time. And when folks looked at forecasts of what's going to be the demand post-COVID,
right,
midst of COVID, I could say con-COVID and post-COVID, what's the demand going to be? And they reduced their orders. When they did that, what that meant is there was going to be a surge when, in fact, demand came surging back. And now there's huge demand everywhere for those parts.
Is just-in-time over? Was COVID the end of just-in-time?
I've heard a lot of things. I've heard just-in-time, just-in-case, right? but actually, one of the things we're looking at is localization. What I think is actually
localization.
Taking global technologies and then manufacturing, making them in regions all around the world so that there can be more immediate sources of supply.
Easier said than done, though. It can take 3 years to build a chip manufacturing facility.
Well, it can. I mean, what I've been doing is talking to audiences everywhere about the idea of a smart investment these days would be in flex factories. By the way, this is something the U.S. government can do. Some people don't know that there's a organic industrial base maintained by the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to put new automation technology in that will make them more flexible.
This is so interesting because you go back several decades, right, and the government got so involved in the U.S. semi industry because we were falling behind. The government has to play a much more active role, in your view?
Well, what we're seeing is things like the CHIPS Act. We are such fans of this idea of the government actually making an investment to help jumpstart chip production. The demand will be there. You know that as we go from the Internet of People
right
into this next decade where it will be people creating the Internet of Things, that there's going to be demand for semiconductors everywhere.
We need to talk about people.
No, we do. Yeah, I want to get an update because a few months ago you did an interview with Bloomberg TV. You said there were 2,000 open roles at Siemens US. Give us an update there. Are you able to fill those roles?
We are constantly working to fill open jobs. And I will tell you today, we still have about 2,000 open jobs. Yes, we're experiencing growth. And we are also experiencing what so many companies are, with people saying, hey, I'd like to do something different. So a couple things I want to do. I want to change the great resignation to the great reassignment. Get managers thinking about, you know what, I may lose an employee, but I'd rather lose them to one of my colleagues in Siemens if there's somebody who wants to do something different. So let's keep them in the family. I'm really hoping a lot of folks will be coming back as well because we've got this vibrant, growing business. Meanwhile, we're putting a ton of investment into creating programs that will bring young people into the fields we and our customers are engaged in. Most recently, working with Wake Technical Community College in North Carolina, we've created an apprenticeship program for 11th graders to come out, learn the tools of the trade for building electric vehicles.
So starting
chargers.
Earlier and earlier, right?
High school apprenticeship is the new wave of the future.
What is the thing that keeps you up at night? Because I think about, all right, supply chain, we talked about it, chips. I mean, these are still issues. We're not over COVID yet. There are still some questions about the economy, trying to fill all these jobs. What is it that really kind of stresses you out right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, now, Carol, I sleep well because I've got a great team. But the thing we focus on as a number one priority, we use the term sustainability. It means a lot of things to a lot of people. But look at where we are right now. We're entering a winter where there's a real question about where will the power come from. So we're doing our part at Siemens to make sure that utilities are prepared, that communities are prepared. We've been installing microgrids, nanogrids, helping people get ready and so that they'll have greater flexibility and control on how they use power. And, oh, by the way, not only is it a matter of resilience, being able to keep the lights on, but this is a turning point for the globe.
Do you feel like all the energy crisis that we've seen as of late, that it is making people much more aware and making sure that they've got the systems in place?
It's making people aware, but the one piece that I don't think we spend enough time on is the idea of an energy transition. We know we need renewables in the future, and we hear a lot of concern that too quick of a step to all renewable can leave us exposed. And frankly, the technology exists today for us to make that transition with clean alternatives that get us to the totally renewable future.
And that was Barbara Humpton, President and CEO of Siemens US. And, you know, they're a massive company, Tim. Industry, infrastructure, transport, healthcare. The US is the company's largest market. 40,000 employees, revenues of about $17 billion annually. But they have a great view and snapshot of so much of our economy.
Yeah, what really struck me, what you said about the energy transition, because I think a lot of people, until recently, it was the case for me, think about the idea of going from fossil fuels to renewables as being, you know, a few years relatively quick. We learned this year, in recent months, this is a process that is going to take decades. Look what happened in Texas. Look what happened in the UK.
Absolutely.
And if it's a cold winter, we expect more of that pain.
It's another transition. We saw it with fracking, where all of a sudden we had an abundance of energy, specifically from the United States. But here we are, certainly in a crunch, and that is impacting everything we do. Anyway, if you missed any of that, check it out on our podcast. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Tim Stenovic, Carol Masser, I know your name. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
live at the Milken Institute Global Conference. And we've got a special guest, Mo Meghji, founder and CEO at M3 Partners. Mo, first of all, nice to have you here. We're getting back to normal. What's life been like for you as we are kind of coming out of the pandemic?
Great to be here. Thank you, Carol.
Yeah.
It's a little choppy, but it's great to be here at the Milken Conference today. First big event that I'm traveling to in terms of conference since COVID. I'd say being based in New York, people are still aren't fully back at work in
right.
Manhattan. So it's sort of slowly coming back. I'd say in the last month, we've seen a lot of people start to come back, being open for dinners or other meetings in person, etc. But it's definitely slow going, and I'm hoping it picks up.
Hey, what do you mean by choppy when you describe it as choppy?
So I'd say, look, my firm, we opened our office in June right after Memorial Day, but we made it 3 days a week on a voluntary basis. We deal with banks, law firms, investors, hedge funds, etc., and they sort of started coming in the summer. Then the Delta variant happened.
Right.
Slowed it right down. People went away. And now we're slowly starting to see signs of people coming back.
But do you feel like we've got 20 seconds and then we'll come back and do some more? But it's, you know, who knows what's to come, right? Whether it's variants or whatever. Like, you always have to kind of think about that still. Right?
I think the uncertainty and the fear is sort of still out there.
Yeah.
Basic things like commuting. Being careful around that. I've started walking a lot more in the city than instead of taking trains and subways. So there are just small changes that are happening all over the place as we readjust to life.
The environment right now, how busy are you?
So in terms of restructurings, the past few months, I'd say since about May, June of this year, it's been very slow in terms of new restructurings. The first 3 or 4 months were very busy with a sort of tail of work from last year. And the last few months have been slow in terms of new opportunities. I've focused on other areas. We have a SPAC business as well.
Right.
So that's kept me very, very busy. And I think we're seeing sort of small early signs of activity in restructuring. But we think it's going to be slow probably until sort of mid next year.
And why? Is that because of the cost of capital right now?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, there's been so much stimulus that's come into the economy. So consumers are out spending. Secondly, so all of these companies, retail, which was a huge area of restructuring last year, energy prices, oil prices have gone from, gone up to $80 this year. So both of those sectors have really sort of recovered very quickly this year. The question is, how long will that recovery last?
Right.
Because obviously you're looking at a stimulus-driven year where the GDP is growing at close to 6% this year.
You were involved with JCPenney, right?
Yes.
Barney's. You were also involved with Neiman Marcus.
Correct.
Have we gotten rid of kind of the excess in retail, or do you think there's another leg at some point?
Look, I think a lot of these companies have very aggressively gone out and shed their kind of bricks-and-mortar footprint.
Yeah.
But depending on what demand does, I mean, this year, every one of these is virtually. I was at speaking to somebody from one of the largest retail lenders in the country recently, last week. When last year 40% of their loan portfolio was in trouble, today they have one loan out of $15 billion portfolio.
That's remarkable.
Not even in deep trouble, but slightly sort of. So I think the retail sector, consumer-led recovery has really come back.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how many of those companies will have moved to sort of the right e-commerce investments, et cetera? And I think when the economy goes to back to 2 or 3% growth rates in the next couple of years, you'll see some of those get back into having issues.
What are the signs that you're seeing right now that the restructuring business could be picking up?
It's just very sector focused. So real estate.
Corporate real estate?
I'd say corporate hospitality real estate are areas where people haven't really, demand hasn't really come back for a variety of reasons. In Manhattan, for instance, a lot of office workers haven't really gone back yet. So I think when those companies don't have the liquidity to continue funding them, there's going to be some activity there. So we're seeing some sort of early signs of that.
So let's talk about the time that you've been able to spend on SPACs. You are someone who is, you know, aware of them, have been involved in them, you know, go back several years. What'd you make of the SPAC craze and kind of where we are right now? Because it certainly has fallen off. It looks like nobody wants to do any at this point.
So it's interesting. It's sort of a, you know.
Quickly, that cycle.
very quick cycle. But I raised my first SPAC back in 2016.
In SPAC years, that's ancient history.
Absolutely. And at the time, a bunch of people looked at me and said, you're nuts. Why would you do that? But we thought it was sort of an ignored kind of unloved vehicle. And if we could go and find a way to use it appropriately. So we raised a SPAC, $150 million SPAC in 16, bought a wind farm construction company in 2018 from Oaktree Capital.
Yeah.
We were probably early, because it was a small cap company, probably early in that cycle. But over time, that company has grown from $500 million in revenue to $2 billion. It's doing extremely well.
Right.
And I think that it turned out to be a very good investment.
How does the SPAC craze this time around? How does it end?
So my view on this is a couple of things. What happened last year and early this year was, you know, sort of irrational exuberance in the SPAC market, clearly.
Yeah.
I think and I expect and hope maybe that SPACs are here to stay as a new asset class. They're not going to be anywhere near the level of issuance you've had in the last 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I think it's a great opportunity for investors to come and play with that as a competitive private equity.
So just got about 40 seconds. So how do we as investors kind of differentiate between the crazy SPAC and the one that makes sense, like yours that you started back in 2016?
Look, we raised another one this year in March. We raised $400 million, our second SPAC. We just announced a deal a month and a half ago with a company called Syniverse, which is an established telecom carrier services and software enterprise software provider.
Right.
Very established company. We bought it at a great multiple. I think the SPAC vehicle is very, very well suited to buying those kinds of companies.
It sounds like do your homework, understand the business, and make sure it's a real business, right? And there's metrics.
Correct. And I think there are many that took flyers on companies that are going to make it in 5 or 10 years, that's probably not going
to
work.
Come back. We would love to continue more with you. Mo Meghji, he's founder and CEO over at M3 Partners, joining us here at Milken. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a twin.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
11 minutes left in the trading session. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, live on the West Coast at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Let's get to the Drive to the Close. Our guest, Aaron Cannon, back with us, CEO at Clear Harbor Asset Management, back with us on the phone in Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Aaron, nice to be talking with you again. I got to ask you, though, because I always remember early on that you were among the first to close your New York offices, set up in Connecticut, during the pandemic and say, this is the way we're going to work going forward and you're going to have flexibility. Are you still doing that?
We are. Thanks for having me back, Carol. We are. We have our headquarters now in Stamford, and I'm looking at the Long Island Sound as I speak with you this afternoon. We do miss New York and the hustle and bustle and the connectivity that it brings, but we're only a short Metro North ride away, and so we feel like we sort of have the best of both worlds at the moment.
And we're going to get into the financial markets, but I am curious what your take is as you watch American Express say, okay, workers, you can now have 4 weeks, you know, flexible work. Do you think ultimately the financial sector more broadly will have to be more flexible despite what you might hear from the Jamie Dimons of this world?
I think it depends. You know, we communicate with our clients frequently. We visit our clients. They visit us. We attend conferences. We have a very flexible work environment here at Clear Harbor Asset Management. But, you know, if you're a bond trader at Citigroup or, you know, one of the large investment banks, it's difficult to do that from home. And I think it really will vary depending on the sort of segment within finance that you're referring to.
Well, Aaron, as Carol mentioned, we are live at the Milken Institute Global Conference 2021. And among the many interesting conversations we've had today includes one with David Hunt, the CEO at PGIM, who talked to us about what he believes truly is the transitory nature of inflation, arguing that we will see technological progress and demographic changes that bring down inflation. I'm wondering if you agree that inflation is transitory.
Well, that's a great point in question. I tend to embrace that view, and I know some in the more entrenched inflationary camp want people like the fellow you referenced at PGIM and perhaps myself to wave the white flag of surrender. But I think it's hard to discount the reality that we're still experiencing significant supply chain bottlenecks that are almost wholeheartedly a function of COVID and the global decision, really, to close down an economy and then just sort of reopen it. And while it's certainly more of a prolonged trend and phenomenon, to sort of suggest that this is sort of the cost-push inflation akin to what we saw during the 1970s, where we saw major wage spikes and really very little productivity gains, we're not in that environment right now. We are seeing some wage inflation across certain segments of the economy, but we're also seeing rather significant unemployment among that same segment that just hasn't come back yet. Over 5 million people without jobs today that had jobs just prior to COVID. And I'd also argue that productivity is significantly higher today than it was during the 1970s. And so the sort of unit labor cost that was such an issue on the entrenched inflationary front in the 1970s, we're just not seeing that right now.
So the 70s is actually a good reference because it does give us an idea of what caused that scenario, that stagflation or stagflationary scenario. And it is very different this time around, safe to say. One thing I do wonder, Aaron, and going back to David Hunt and just thinking about the Fed and its metrics, that the labor market, people are retiring. There may be people who just don't come back to work, so that maybe we need to rethink how we measure labor force participation. Maybe it's not going to be what it was pre-pandemic, and we need to maybe think about it differently going forward.
Yeah, I think time will tell on that, Carol, for sure. There are lots of questions that we all have around this issue. You know, at the end of the day, I'm encouraged by the productivity gains that we seem to both anecdotally and statistically be gleaning and seeing throughout this COVID period that give me hope that, and I think justifiable hope, that some of the inflationary pressures are not only going to subside, but even some of the wage pressures are going to subside going forward as we see higher productivity, you know, at sort of over 2% on an annualized basis.
What is it that you think will help with those wage pressures? And that's something we're going to certainly be listening for as we do get into the midst of earnings season. We've got a handful of earnings this week, including Netflix and Tesla. But what is it that you think about wage growth that won't get so hot?
Well, I think at the end of the day, there's still significant concerns. You know, sitting here in the Northeast in Stamford, Connecticut, sometimes you don't feel it, but I think we need to be sensitive to some of the concerns that are out there about return to work, about return to school, both parents, you know, sort of feeling comfortable working full time while their children, you know, are sort of wading through COVID with masks on in school. So I think there's that element, but there's also, you know, it's just earlier in September that the unemployment bonuses came to an end, and so we're only in October a month later, And I suspect that some of those people that were benefiting from those unemployment bonuses are still sort of determining where they go next and how they return to the fore. But keep in mind, a lot of this wage inflation is happening in specific segments of the economy, like hospitality and restaurants. And I'm sure you're both seeing it, both out there and back home in New Jersey and New York. I'm certainly seeing it. But it's not evident across the overall economy. And I think it's important to sort of highlight that. We read headlines even on the Bloomberg Terminal that, you know, that wages are jumping everywhere, but they're just not. The statistics suggest otherwise.
Yeah, and safe to say that there's a fair amount of turnover, so maybe the wage inflation, depending on where the economy kind of settles itself, that maybe it will be so problematic. Hey, just quickly, Aaron, just got about 40 seconds here. So investment strategy, what are you advising your clients?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, every client of ours at Clear Harbor is different. They have different goals. They have different sort of risk tolerance. We have non-for-profit clients. We have families. And, you know, staying the course on, you know, putting together a risk-adjusted sort of asset allocation strategy is what we're telling our clients right now. We're going through a period of great uncertainty as it pertains to the directionality of inflation and growth. And we don't think making significant changes in the midst of this moment is a great idea.
Yep, there's lots of volatility out there, too. Aaron Kennan, co-founder and chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/FutureInvestor/radio.